You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Anthony Rendazzo is with us, the Director of Economic Research with the Reason Foundation, reason.org. Anthony, am I pronouncing that right?
Rendazzo, you got it right.
Great. Thanks for joining us. You have a recent article titled "Sally Mae and Uncle Sam: Cronyism in Higher Education Finance." And I'm with you in Sally Mae having been semi-privatized and then publicized and all this kind of thing. But you know, the larger question: Thomas Jefferson thought his number one accomplishment, or one of his top three accomplishments, was not being president of the United States. He chose not to put that on his tombstone, but rather that he had started the University of Virginia, which was a free college for anybody who could attend. Abraham Lincoln, one of his proudest accomplishments, was gathering tens of millions of acres of land across the United States and giving that to states to create land-grant colleges so that they could, you know, make money from that land so that people could go to college for free. And we had the GI Bill doubled the number of college graduates we had in this country and launched the 60s and 70s, an era of incredible competitiveness. Why shouldn't college be free for anybody in this country who wants to go and is capable of going?
Well, I think I heard most of what you said. I dropped off the phone. Hopefully you can still hear me using this. I completely agree with you on the value of education. And the current system right now is broken. We both agree on that. My frustration is the idea of free education for all, I think, is going to harm more people than the current situation the way that it is. So we both want improvement, but the idea of trying to offer free education for everybody, moving everybody from current for-profit institutions and non-profit private institutions into the public institutions across the United States just isn't feasible on the one hand.
Why can every other developed country do it and we can't? Is it because we're afraid to tax the billionaires?
But it's not so much even the resources at hand, although that's, you know, that certainly is a
problem. We were doing it fine before Reagan became governor of California.
We've had private institutions since the founding of America.
I'm not saying do away with private institutions. You know, if somebody wants to go to Harvard or Cornell and pay $50,000, $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year, no problem. You know, we've always had colleges for rich people, and I don't care if we do into the future. I'm talking about average working people and poor people being able to go to college without coming out of the college, you know, so in debt that they're going to be paying it off for the first 20 years of their life and they won't be able to start a family or won't be able to buy a house. That seems crazy to me.
That's not the American dream. I think that one of the reasons that college is like that is because of crony capitalist institutions like Sally Mae and the fact that there has been so much federal government involvement in student loans, which has driven up the cost of education.
No, it's the opposite of that. When Reagan came into office, 80% of college tuition was paid for by state governments, local governments, federal governments, or the colleges themselves as institutions like, you know, Michigan State University making money as a land-grant college off their ag programs on their land. 80% of college tuition was paid for by those institutions. Only 20% was paid by students. Today, about 80% of college tuition is paid for by students because, you know, ever since Reagan declared war on public education.
In the 1980s, you've seen a drastic increase in the amount of loans that the federal government, not states, that the federal government has granted to individuals.
That's because students desperately need the money to go to school.
Right. You know, absolutely. A huge part of that is because of incomes and parents' incomes and a huge demographic changes and the cost of higher education having risen so much has demanded in this sort of like nasty cycle the need for more loans because it keeps going up. The more credit that becomes available, the more demand that there is for institutions. So you're going to have institutions rise, you know, increasing prices. Tom, you have states like Florida, right? Like
you are confusing cause with effect. If the percentage of college education that is being paid for by the student has quadrupled since the Reagan Revolution, has gone up 400%, then of course students are, you know, they're picking up four times as much they're going to have to go into debt. And, you know, we as a society have said, okay, fine, you know, we'll help them with some of that debt. The banksters have been very happy to help them with that debt. And I realize you want to turn the whole thing over to the banksters, you know, which scares the hell out of me. But what I'm saying they shouldn't even have that debt in the first place, much less your solution of turning it over to the banksters.
I certainly don't want a crony capitalist Wall Street that is leveraging its own subsidies for its own solvability to be able to make profit off the system. It bothers me the idea of a student getting a loan and going to a private institution, or sort of a for-profit institution, that loan being subsidized by the government. All of that.
What's wrong with that?
All that's highly problematic. It's a form of crony capitalism. It's not something.
Let's get rid of the loans.
What I want is lower cost of education, and even the idea that we talk about everybody getting a college education.
I'm not saying everybody. I'm saying everybody is capable and wants to. We need to have trade schools. We need to have, other things.
And so what is that? That's human capital, right?
Yes.
Let's invest in human capital. Developing human capital.
Yes.
Now, there are states that have programs like Florida, where in Florida, if you get a certain score on your SAT, you get 100% tuition at a Florida public institution. If you hit another level, you get 75%.
Right. Same thing.
Those public institutions are full of students. I mean, University of Central Florida is one of the biggest colleges in the country. What you're going to get there is a decent education, not a great education. And that's part of my concern is if you expand a huge program across like that, where the federal government is guaranteeing if you want to go to a public school, we're going to cover it, that we're going to lower the quality of education for everybody.
That's not what's happened until Reagan came along and put the profit motive into education. It used to be that, you know, the only schools that were operating for profit in the 80s and 90s, as somebody who's old enough to remember, were called diploma mills. And you know, back in the day, and every school in the country of any merit was a nonprofit institution, and they were running as nonprofit institutions for the purpose of educating students. And 80% of the tuition was paid for by government or the college. And now that only roughly 20% of the tuition is paid for by government or the college, you know, all this debt is being loaded on these students, and you've got students graduating as debt slaves. This is nuts.
It's not something that is going to lead to a thriving American economy.
No,
a lot of
it's not. Reaganomics is destroying this country.
A lot of the degrees that people even have right now with their loaded up debt aren't focused on what we need in terms of developing the economy for the future. That's another part of my concern is if you're going to have the federal government driving all higher education in the United States, that's not the idea that that's going to lead to a dynamic distribution of higher education for what we need in the future, I think is ridiculous.
It works in Finland. It works in Denmark. It works in Sweden. It works in Switzerland. It works in Germany. It works in France. It works all over the world. It's working in China right now.
As somebody that has studied economics as much as you have, it really surprises me that you believe in those kinds of macro level comparisons. It's difficult to compare one county in Michigan next to another.
Okay, it worked in the United States. It worked in the United States during my dad's generation when millions of men went to college on the GI Bill, not only free, but my dad got $100 a month stipend. It worked here in the United States.
The GI Bill was successful in paying for a lot of students to go to college. Now, what happened when you had all of those students rushing into a university system that was sort of building itself out in America that had a lot of opportunities?
What happened was it tightened the labor force, raised wages, and you had a middle class.
You had a massive explosion in economic growth. That's not America today.
No, it's not because of Reaganomics.
And that might be true. But the fact of the matter is, America today is not America of the 1950s. We can't use 1950s economic or education policy.
Okay. Well, that's true. Anthony Mendoza, I guess we'll agree on that. Director of Economic Research with the Reason Foundation, Reason.org. You can read all about it. His most recent piece, Sallie Mae and Uncle Sam, Cronyism in Higher Education Finance. Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
My apologies for the bad audio. We were having a little bit of a problem with our call screen software. It's back up and running. We'll be right back. Okay, so welcome back to the place where smart people get the news. I think you get it, my opinion on all this, that frankly, at the very least, We need to go back to the formula where students are only paying a small percentage of the cost of going to college. And that way we can go back to the days like, you know, in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up, where you can work a summer job and make enough money to pay college tuition for the rest of the year. Maybe not to Harvard, but certainly to a land-grant college like MSU or University of Michigan or Wayne State University. Those are the ones I know of in Michigan. There's probably a few others in Michigan, actually. And you know, other colleges around the country. But, you know, conservatives don't like that. Libertarians don't like that. They want the government out of the business of education altogether, make students pay 100% of the cost, and then if they need to borrow money to go to college, have them deal with Bank of America or Goldman Sachs. Jamie Dimon's got a deal for you. I think it's crazy. Along those same lines, Rush Limbaugh, a couple of days ago on his show, this is why sometimes you find it so hard to have a reasonable conversation with your crazy brother-in-law over Thanksgiving dinner, and you know, about economics or politics, is because you've got these media pundits like Rush Limbaugh going off on stuff that just simply ain't so. I mean, it's like having cult members try to convince you that humans came from the planet Xenu, and someday when we're all clear, the spaceships are going to show up and take us all back, which seems to work for some movie stars, but not most people, I think. So anyhow, here's Limbaugh. He says, he quotes a New York Times article by Ann Lowry, and quotes the article as saying, President Obama says prosperity does not trickle down and that a rising tide does not lift all boats. The conservative policies predicated on those ideas, Obama maintains, amount to a you're-on-your-own economics when the country really needs a we're-in-this-together approach. So then comes Limbaugh commenting on it. In short, what Obama is going to say in these speeches, he says, president is going to say, and there's a few ellipses in here, the whole thing is rather long, but the president, I'm not taking out anything that I think changes the context of this. The president is going to say that prosperity comes from the middle out rather than the top down. And then Limbaugh makes this astounding comment. Never mind that this has never, not once, worked. It has never succeeded, this formula. The middle class leading the economic rebound. It's not possible. The middle class benefits from it, but an economic recovery is not caused by the middle class. An economic expansion is not caused by the middle class. The middle class, by and large, are consumers, says Limbaugh. So what causes that economic expansion? If it's not people getting decent paychecks and then going to the store with those decent paychecks and buying things so that the stores then have to buy those things from their wholesalers, so the wholesalers have to buy them from the manufacturers, and the manufacturers have to hire people to make them so that those people go to work making things and they get a decent paycheck and then they go to the store and buy. You know, I mean, this is called the virtuous cycle. This is something that Adam Smith wrote about in Wealth of Nations in 1776. It has stood as economic theory. Demand drives economy. It has stood as economic theory without challenge from 1776 until 1982, when Ronald Reagan had dinner with a couple of wackadoodles, and one of them pulled out a napkin, or it was sitting on the table, and he drew, you know, Art Laffer, he drew this curve. And suddenly we had supply-side economics. Ronnie Reagan, you know, kind of on the road to Alzheimer's dementia, looks at that and goes, oh, that makes sense. Rich people make us rich. Or rich people create the middle class. Forgetting that if the middle class doesn't work and doesn't buy things, rich people don't exist. But here's what Limbaugh has to say about it.
In order for the middle class to consume to the level that economic growth takes place, they must be paid a lot of money. And in order for that to happen, the businesses where they work must grow. The places where they are employed must do well. They must be making more. They must have more customers than they're servicing. Whatever the enterprise is, it has to grow so that people working there earn more, get raises, get more benefits, and so that new people get hired.
This idea that the economy bubbles up from below is absurd. So, in Limbaughnomics, when businesses grow magically, because rich people decide to make them grow, when businesses grow, when businesses do well, right? In order for that to happen, the businesses they work for must grow. The places they are employed must do well. They must be making more. They must have more customers they're serving. Whatever the enterprise is, it has to grow. So when rich people and businesses are doing well, then, Limbaugh says, in order for the middle class to consume to that level of to the level that economic growth takes place, they must be paid a lot of money. So therefore, when the businesses do well, they pay their workers well, says Limbaugh. Well, up until 1980, businesses did pay their workers well. We had unions that forced them to, basically. But now, you know, since Reaganomics, not so much. The income of working people in this country since Ronald Reagan came into office has actually fallen. The income of the CEOs and the investor class, the Mitt Romneys of the world, the Donald Trumps of the world, it's up over 275%. If you look at the top 100th of 1%, it's up, you know, over 1,000%. So, no. I mean, businesses are doing really well right now. The corporate profits right now, last quarter, were higher than they have been in the United States in over 50 years. CEO pay is higher than it has been since the 19th century. And we really didn't keep good numbers back then. It might be higher than it's ever been in the history of America. Investors are making more money than ever. Look at the stock market. Is any of that translating into higher wages like Limbaugh says? No.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the guy is basically hallucinating and then dumping this on his poor listeners, and then they show up at your Thanksgiving dinner. The middle class never causes an economic recovery, says Limbaugh. Really? If you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. Only rich people cause economic recovery, says Ayn Rand. Do you ever wonder if you've ever read Atlas Shrugged? And I realize probably most of you haven't. They sell a lot of copies, and it's one of those books that people, you know, they get and they leave on the coffee table, or they stick on the shelf, or they, you know, use as a doorstop. It is that big. You know, if you're into purple prose and bad fiction. But, you know, the basic premise of Atlas Shrugged is that there was a bunch of rich people running the country. It's told through the lens of a brother and sister who inherited a railroad from their father. And how that has anything to do with merit, I don't understand. But in any case, they're rich and they inherited this money from Papa. And there's a fellow who's invented a new kind of metal for for railroads, to let them go faster, and the union is concerned that this stuff might be dangerous and wants it to be tested a little more before they start running railroad cars on it, because the union workers might die. And the brother and sister who own the railroad company say, screw the union and screw the government that wants to test this stuff and have us prove that it's safe before we use it. Regulations suck. But the government persists and the unions persist, and so this guy, John Galt, is the first of all the rich people who says, you know, we don't need these government regulations. We don't need no stinking regulations. We don't need no stinking unions. In fact, we don't even need no stinking workers. We're rich people. And so everybody starts going, and he leaves. And everybody starts going, where's John Galt? And John Galt has taken off. And pretty soon they all follow him, and they go to their own little paradise someplace and start a libertarian society. And I'm wondering, when they start that libertarian society, who cleans their toilets? Who washes their dishes? Who vacuums their floors? I mean, it's quite clear that Dagny Taggart isn't going to do it. Or John Galt. Or, for that matter, who makes their toilets? Who builds their houses? Who makes the mops for their floors? Somehow Ayn Rand overlooks all that stuff. So anyhow, people who believe this fantasy, this libertarian objectivist fantasy in Atlas Shrugged, have this bizarre notion that it's the rich people of the world who create economies, who drive economies, who create wealth, who make people rich, who make it all happen. And they're wrong. And, you know, three centuries of economics, arguably seven millennia of economics, proves that they're wrong. Whether you're looking at Sumeria 7,000 years ago, you're looking at the Roman Republic 3,000 years ago, or the Greek democracy 3,000 years ago, the Roman Republic 2,000 years ago, every country in history, wealth is created by, as Adam Smith pointed out in Wealth of Nations, wealth is created by labor being applied to raw materials, by people making things. And then there's this whole chain of people who make money off that initial wealth, off that initial manufacturing, by packaging it, by marketing it, by selling it at wholesale, by retailing it. There's a whole chain of people who make money off that initial wealth. But they're not actually generating wealth. They're just skimming a little off the top of the real wealth of nations, as Adam Smith lays out. And by the way, if you're going to read Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, really, his other book, A Theory of Moral Sentiments, is an even more important book. It's a better book, and it includes all the information that's in Wealth of Nations, Theory of Moral Sentiments. And in that book, he talks about how important it is never to have a libertarian society or a libertarian economy, which is why you never hear conservatives quoting Adam Smith. Generally, you don't hear them quoting Adam Smith because they're afraid that somebody who actually understands and has read Adam Smith will come along and say, but what about Theory of Moral Sentiments? In that book, he literally warns us about rich people, about people who are motivated by profit, working against the best interests of society as a whole. So, anyhow, Limbaugh then continues his rant. He says, that's what Obama's going to sell, though. Obama's going to sell. We got to take money from the rich, and we got to raise taxes on businesses. We got to get that money to the middle class where it'll cause the economy to grow. Yeah, Obama is saying that. Let's raise some money from taxes. You know, the top tax rate was 74% when Reagan came into office, and this country was working just fine, thank you very much, and had been for a half a century. A little less than that, but, you know, since World War II. And we were using that money to pay for unemployment benefits. And we were using that money to pay for education. And we were using that money to pay for new schools and new hospitals, which were all nonprofit, by the way, and most, virtually 100% of them, were owned by local communities and run by local communities. And the costs were low. I remember starting a business in Michigan in 1972. 1973, we were making enough money we could offer all our employees health insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield in Michigan. And my recollection, and I'm pretty sure it's accurate, was it cost us $35 per person per month. It was a nonprofit corporation. You couldn't do health insurance on a for-profit basis in the state. It was a crime. You'd go to jail if you tried to. So anyhow, Limbaugh says, you start taking money away, just like the government takes from the private sector shrinks. Well, yes, if you just took that money away and put it in a Swiss bank. But if you take that money away from the investor class, if you say to the guys on Wall Street who are making $2 billion a year, you know, you're going to have to pay 73% income tax after your first $3 million a year. And we're going to take that money, and we are going to give it to poor people and working class people in the form of free college education and good free health care so they have a social safety net, so they can be educated and they can go out and start their own businesses. If you do that, and you are saying to business owners, you must pay your employees a decent wage, then surprise, surprise, you're going to have an economy that actually works. Now, Limbaugh's not going to tell you this because his last contract, he was bragging about it. His last contract with Clear Channel, the Premier, was for $400 million. I mean, when you got $400 million and your job is to be a talk show host about politics, I guess it makes sense to try to convince everybody that people who are worth $400 million are the ones who are making people rich. But I don't see how Limbaugh is making anybody rich other than maybe his producer. And I have no idea what he pays his producer. But if he's putting the rest of that money in a Swiss bank account, it's not helping the economy. I mean, yeah, he's got a big mansion down in Florida, and I suppose when it was first built, before he bought it, it generated some jobs. But right now, there's what? His maid who brings him the OxyContin? I mean, that's about it. Maybe he's got a few other people. Maybe he's got a butler and a valet. I don't know. Pool boy. But really? Rush Limbaugh with his $400 million is driving the economy? Really? That's what he wants you to believe? And if somebody wants to go to college, they should go so far in debt for it that the first 20 years out of college, forget about starting a family, forget about getting married, forget about buying a house. You got to pay off your student loans. It's insane. James in Silverton, Oregon. Hey, James, you're on the air.
Good life from the sad.
James?
To me.
James does not know he's on the air. Okay. Alan in San Francisco, California. Hey, Alan, you got to listen to your radios. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Tom, I have a question in regards to this idea of trickle-down economics.
Mm-hmm.
Has anyone ever called the Republicans bluff? And we know it's a bluff, you know, obviously, based on the historical record. But has anyone ever called the Republicans bluff and told them that they can have these tax cuts for the corporations if the tax cuts are contingent upon job creation?
No, because what would happen is if you said, sure, you can have your tax cuts as long as you create jobs. I mean, that's essentially the deal that Reagan made. He said, you know, we're going to give them tax cuts and they're going to create jobs. George W. Bush, too. He said, we're going to, you know, give them tax cuts. They're going to create jobs. After the Bush tax cuts, we had the slowest economic growth. And I'm not talking about the Great Crash. I'm talking just after the cuts in 2002. We had the slowest economic growth in this country for the rest of his administration that we have had since World War II, since the Great Depression. And after Reagan had his tax cuts, it slowed down economic growth as well. So, and when when Clinton raised taxes, economic growth went up. So, I don't think you had to call their bluff. All you had to do is point to history. But, yes, we have on a number of occasions given tax cuts to corporations in the hopes that they would create jobs, and they didn't. So we just need to point it out. Thank you, Alan. Excellent point. Merritt in Zilla, Washington, got a minute to the break. You disagree about the economic problem?
Well, I'm just thinking that maybe if everybody were a little more self-reliant and didn't have to run to Walmart for their groceries and run to the gas station so often and
In other words, grew their own food, you mean?
Become so dependent on the big business.
Do you mean people should grow their own food?
Yeah, homestead your backyard, those kinds of things. And in that way, a little bit of pride and a little bit of self-worth and esteem might enter into some of these issues.
How can you farm your backyard, Merritt, if you're working three jobs, working 12 hours a day at minimum wage just to be able to live a top of the poverty level lifestyle?
Well, first of all, you have to be healthy and you have to have energy, and you're not going to get that if you're buying your food at Walmart.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Maybe not. I'm hearing a liner on top of my in my ear right now. Excuse me, Shane. Merritt, I'm sorry. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, Mercury was supposed to go direct, no longer retrograde, on Saturday. I'm thinking there's another week here. Or it's the full moon. We'll be right back. Talk media for the sane among us. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And Adam in New Haven, Connecticut. Hey, Adam.
Hey, just wanted to comment regarding the first segment of your show where you were debating the guy there. I wanted to say that, by today's standards, Henry VIII, the Tudor
king, mm-hmm.
He would be considered a liberal commie by those guys because he created King's College, which allowed children of poor families to attend the college.
Really?
And collect a certain number of, families, kids who are very smart, and they got to go to King's College. And as a result, a person like, there's this guy, William Harvey, who discovered circulation systems. He wasn't poor.
Mm-hmm.
He came from a poor family.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just that. And
it's amazing. I did not know that. Henry VIII was the first liberal, or one of that he created a free college system. Thank you for sharing that, Adam. I'll have to look that up. I appreciate the call. Bob in Homewood, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yes, sir. Tom, nice talking to you. I appreciate your show. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just want to revert back to this educational system with the U.S. versus Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Just a short story. My younger son graduated high school in the States, went to St. Patrick's just outside Dublin, did his master's at Trinity in Dublin, and then got his doctorate in Jyväskylä University in Finland. None of this would have been possible in the States because I had just lost my job with a company after 20 years. They closed their doors.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I could not have sent him to school. And if he had gone to school and college in this country and accomplished those things, he'd have been well over $100,000 in debt.
So he went to college for free in those countries?
Yes, sir.
How did he qualify for that as an American?
Well, he qualified for that because of the principal at the school he attended here, which was a parochial high school in Chicago by the name of Mount Carmel, interceded with the dean of men at the St. Patrick's College just outside Dublin. My son wanted to go there because he had taken a trip with the senior class to Europe, and he enjoyed the atmosphere.
Right. Oh, Dublin's a great city.
Yeah, see, because you are supposed to have just 3 years of college over there,
mm-hmm.
right? They did not know that if he'd be qualified in making that jump, I'm seeing here jumping over actually the first year of college
mm-hmm.
and then entering.
Yeah.
But they went on the principal's assurance that he was that type of student. So they accepted him, and then the rest of it was just followed.
So what you're saying is the college is free in Ireland, and where else did he go? And Finland?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I went over there for a trip with him to Helsinki, and the people over there are fantastic. They're taught 3 and 4 different languages by the time they even get to secondary school.
You're absolutely right.
And it's incredible.
Yeah. In fact, in Holland, you have to learn four languages before you can get into high school, basically. I mean, it's really quite remarkable, and college is free. And why, you know, I think one of the reasons, Bob, that most Americans are not, like, literally out in the streets or up in arms, and why college students are not, you know, rioting in the United States or something, you know, or some metaphorical equivalent. I'm not, you know, wishing for riots, but something, is that they don't travel outside the United States. Americans have no idea what it's like in the rest of the world and how good it is.
They don't understand. Like right now, my son is a professor at Queen's University in Belfast,
mm-hmm.
and he would never had done that without the system being what it was.
Yeah, there you go. And we just, you know, it's just the average American has no clue. Bob, thanks for sharing that story, and thanks for calling in. Janet in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Janet.
Yes, Tom. My question is regarding our sequester, which has hurt so many people in this country. Does the sequester apply to things like small arms and secure in Syria, and also our aid to other countries?
Is
being affected at all by this so-called sequester?
Yeah. Janet, I honestly don't know the answer to the question. I'm sorry. I think, though, let me add, I think that arming the rebels in Syria is a big mistake. I think that, you know, we should have learned that mistake when we armed the rebels in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. The head of those rebels was a guy by the name of Osama bin Laden. We helped him create his organization, which we call today Al-Qaeda. And, you know, there's a movie about this called Charlie Wilson's War that's really worth watching. And you would think that we would have learned by now. Jana, thank you for the call. Eric in Ventura, California. Hey, Eric.
Hey, how you doing, Dom?
Great.
Basically, yeah, I was calling. I wasn't calling to try to bash on you or anything like that. But
feel free.
I noticed you call a lot of attention to the Republican Party, in the pockets of the corporations. I 100% agree with you on that. But I don't think you call enough attention to the problem of the Democratic Party in the same boat in the same situation.
Right.
You look at our president now, his biggest, you know, the biggest spender on his campaigns was General Electric, which is the largest defense contractor, I mean, arguably the largest defense contractor that exists. And, I mean, we see it over and over again, and it's just...
I'm not going to dispute, Eric, that the that many of the Democrats, particularly the more powerful Democrats, are in the pockets of some very large corporations. You pretty much have to be in order to survive politically in America, which is a real tragedy, and that's why I tell everybody to go to movetoamend.org and get money out of politics. But, for example, when the Koch brothers started promoting legislation and a pledge, a literal Grover Norquist-type pledge of I will not raise taxes on carbon, you know, I will not do anything, you know, or I will take down the EPA. Those things, when they have been brought forward as legislation, have been supported. We did a show on this last night on the TV show. 100% by Republicans. 100%. The Koch brothers pretty much exclusively support Republicans. The Republicans are the target for these groups because they are proud to be sold out. Democrats are embarrassed to be sold out. And some of them, like, you know, like Sherrod Brown, Bernie Sanders, some of them are fortunate enough not to be sold out at all. So, Eric, yeah, you're right. There's some problems in the Democratic Party. To fix it, you need to join the Democratic Party.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike Papantoni on the line with us, the attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. Hey, Pap, how you doing today?
Tom, how you doing?
Just great. Detroit. I when I was 2 years old, I lived in Detroit. When I was 22 years old, maybe 21, I lived in Detroit for about a year. When Louise was pregnant with our first, I guess I was 22. I needed health insurance, so I got a job as an engineer with RCA in Detroit, and lived in and I, you know, I grew up in Michigan. I know that city inside out, and it is just tragic to see what's going on there. And I understand you've been mulling this over, ruminating on it at some length.
Well, it's kind of like this last story that you did on TPP, where you you know, the Clinton White House, the Bush White House, and just about everybody in D.C. has given us NAFTA, CAFTA, and SHAFTA, and now TPP is in the works. And now the connect, now we see what that does. When you ship all the manufacturing jobs out of the country, you have urban areas that are heavily manufacturing areas that end up going bankrupt. It's not just happening in Detroit, I can assure you. And so all of a sudden, this is good news for the Republicans who want, or the conservatives. It's not just Republicans anymore. I hate to even just put it in that one in that one label, but the conservatives who want to privatize everything, this is a great opportunity, because what they've done is they've swept up these pensions. This is the first step: take people's pensions that have worked so hard their entire career for the municipal government there, and then the second thing you do is you say, listen, you're not able to give an adequate accounting for things like sewage, water, police, you name it. If it's a public service, they say you just can't do it as a municipality or as a government, therefore we need to privatize it. And so all those things are coming into play in Detroit. Chapter 9 has been a great avenue for the real neocons where it comes to trying to divide, you know, to create the argument that, gee whiz, labor has done this to Detroit because we had to pay those high pensions, and they ignore the fact that it doesn't have anything to do with that. It has to do with the fact that they've had corporate giveaways, the tax base is disappearing, they've subsidized corporations, given big tax breaks to the point to where they don't have any money left. And so Detroit is simply just it's kind of the, you know, it's the parrot in the mine that's telling us that something's wrong.
Yeah, canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think so too. And it's telling us about our trade policies. It's telling us about our you know, about the wonders of Republican libertarianism that says we don't need public services like good schools. And and at another level, it's also telling us about how institutional racism works, because as Detroit got more and more African American, 85%, it's the most African American city in America. that institutional discrimination that's kicking in. You know, that old Harvard study, well, not old, it was done in 2004, where they submitted to corporations all over America who were advertising for employees with very specific requirements. You know, we're looking for somebody with a master's degree, 2 years experience, doing such and such, blah, 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 blah. And they created identical resumes for an identical person, two identical people, slight differences, so, you know, the company didn't catch it. But, and one had a name like Letitia, and the other had a name like Alice.
Right.
And they submitted them to these companies. And then they found that the Letitia's got about 40% fewer callbacks.
Yeah.
And so, surprise, surprise, when you have institutional racism, it creates poverty. When you have poverty, it creates problems.
Hmm. Well, this is imposed poverty. You know, our politicians have known that you can't continue shipping jobs out of the country, especially in heavily manufacturing areas. 80%. Tom, of the America's population live in heavily urban areas.
Yeah.
So this is not something that's just going to be unique to Detroit. We're going to start seeing this more and more. The subpart to this story, I just think, is interesting. It's almost like an effort to balkanize part of the United States. You now have a serious discussion. I mean, you have some billionaires up in Detroit that want to take Belle Isle. It's Belle Isle is a development there in Detroit. You're familiar with it.
It's a beautiful island out in the Detroit River that used to have a theme park or a park in it with a Ferris wheel and all kinds of cool
stuff.
That's
right.
Yeah.
And so what they want to do is they want to privatize Belle Isle. They want to pay $1 billion for it, these developers. And they say if we do that, we can charge people $350,000 just for the right to live there. We can have our own money system. We can have our own laws written. But it's going to be an exclusive gated community. But it's right. Not that it really isn't that this might really happen. It is that the discussion is seriously on the table. Yeah. And if you really think about it, that's where this whole neocon thing has tried to push us. That is, shrink government down to the size that's small enough to drown in a bathtub. You do that. One way to do that, obviously, is to bankrupt the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been part of this process. Unfortunately, I'd love to say that Washington has done something about it. They have whistled past the graveyard on this when time and time again people have told them you've got to save our cities because the interconnection of an entire economy in the United States is dependent on a thriving city. And Detroit is it's bad news for a lot of reasons. And you have Snyder up there who can't wait to push through a Chapter 9. And you have a judge.
Chapter 9 bankruptcy.
Yes, Chapter 9 bankruptcy. And you have a judge, Gerald Rosen, up there, who's probably inclined to go along with it in one form or fashion if you look at his history as a federal judge.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of important things, but I can't. The worst thing that I have this vision of a Monaco sitting there, you know, this city state, independent city state on Belle Isle, that is kind of how I visualize what's happening throughout this country.
You know, that river is the border between the United States and Canada. And so that island, if my recollection is correct, I believe that that's the waterway that connects Lake Erie and Lake Huron. And so if my geographical recollection is correct, I've never been to Belle Isle, but I, you know, like I said, I lived in Detroit for a year and I know the area. And if that's the case, then maybe they'll occupy it and then try to declare independence.
Yeah.
Create their own.
Well,
Ayn Randville.
The story to me is the discussion is seriously on the table.
Yeah.
Part of the discussion, of course, we hear from coming from the right is this: Detroit is just happened because of greedy unions that bankrupt the cities because they demanded too much in pensions. Heavy taxation has run business out of Detroit, which is not so far from the truth. Regulators and regulations have stifled business. Teachers, firemen, and police are paid too much money. It's all those right-wing talking points that are they've all come to bear there. And the real truth is we know why it's happened, because when you ship jobs out of the country, you have places like Detroit where people can't work because there is no work because we've shipped the jobs to Saipan.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, if you look at the internal logic of what they're saying people have pensions, right? They have and they have, which would mean that they have money to spend. If they have money to spend, they're spending money in that community, which
right.
creates jobs, which creates a tax base. People, you know, greedy union people are demanding decent wages. Well, if they were, actually back when they were, that getting those decent wages would mean that they're paying decent taxes and the city wouldn't be in trouble.
Well, it's another analysis of the idea. Capitalism requires that you put money at the bottom, not at the top, because at the top it doesn't trickle down. From the bottom, it does trickle up.
Right.
And we've lost sight of that just at every turn because all the money is now being held at the top. But this isn't unique. I mean, you can go Kentucky. I just saw a story. Kentucky, they raided the public pension programs. At the same time, they financed, a $1.8 billion tax subsidies for wealthy businesses. And then at the end, they said, gee whiz, the pension program's at risk. We may have to declare bankruptcy.
Yeah. Well, and part of that goes back to Reagan's changing the rules so that pensions didn't have to be listed on the books of companies and cities as liabilities, but instead could be listed as assets.
Right.
So they inflated the values of companies when they got sold, and then the buyers would just deplete that asset, which is mind-boggling when you think about it.
It's a new way of business. Now it's struck cities, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire Radio. Check it out, ringoffireradio.com. Pap, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And keep up the great work. Keep telling great stories, you and Bobby Kennedy and Sam Cedar and David Bender. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes or 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That is ringoffireradio.com. Steve King talking about immigrants and using some pretty ugly metaphors. And in fact, I was playing with the idea of maybe we should get Steve King on to talk to him. Do you really mean it? Because he's been a guest on this program many times. I think he knows that, you know, he can say what he wants to say here, and I'm not going to call him obscene names or something. He may end up not looking all that great, but whatever. But do you really mean this kind of stuff? But even John Boehner had to come out and say what Steve King said does not reflect the values of the American people or the Republican Party. So that's pretty amazing stuff. That is actually very amazing stuff. And then the Republican Party mascot, Ted Nugent, you can read this over Daily Kos, has things to say about black Americans. Yes, just what we need, another riff on black Americans from another white guy. Now, I confess, as a white guy, I did a riff on black Americans yesterday. But I think that, I don't think that Ted Nugent has anything really to contribute to this situation. The Republicans are promoting this this new idea, as it were, that it's all Obama's fault, right? Everything is Obama's fault. If we go back to January 2009, the night that President Obama was inaugurated, keep in mind he was elected in November of 2008. He was inaugurated on January 20th, as I recall, wasn't it? I think, of 2009. And on that night, in the caucus room restaurant, in a private room in the back, 15 or 18 Republicans got together with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich has admitted this on this program. Got together and said, you know, we're going to block everything he does. And there was a little window there of 6 or 8 or 12 weeks where he actually had a majority in both houses and could get some things done and got a lot done during that little window. I mean, you know, ended predatory lending, stop lost time for troops, stop tortures, increase VA spending, let women serve on subs, equal pay for women, nuclear arms reduction and disposal. Got BP to pay $20 billion, strengthened the EPA, broadened powers of the FDA, put through a 9/11 responders health care funding, repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, middle class tax cut, the largest in history, saved Chrysler, saved GM. Went from 800,000 monthly job losses to monthly gains now, job gains for about 4 years in a row, three and change. Increased education spending, decreased the cost of student loans, strengthened hate crimes, got through the Affordable Care Act, the CHIPS program, Children Health Insurance Program, started enforcing child labor laws again, reformed to some extent Wall Street, Dodd-Frank, credit card reform. I mean, got a lot done in a short time. But then the Republicans took charge again And for the last 3 years and change, they have said no to everything. And so things are falling apart. As the president pointed out yesterday, yeah, we can muddle through. We're a large nation. We've got a lot of natural resources. We've got a lot of creative energy. But, you know, with 12 million known unemployed people and probably 17 to 20 million people who are unemployed, underemployed, or misemployed, and maybe more than that, frankly, I think it's probably more like 30 million. You know, when you have major hotel chains bragging about the fact that their busboys have bachelor's degrees, you know there's something wrong. That the economy is not working the way it could or it should, and it's not working that way because the Republicans don't want it to, because they don't want a Democrat in the White House to get credit for a good economy. And they intend to run in 2016 against whoever is the Democratic nominee. I'm predicting Hillary, but against whoever is the Democratic nominee, they intend to run against that person on a platform of Obama couldn't fix the economy, put a Republican in. Like, hey, let's try George Bush's stuff again. That really worked. Or Ronald Reagan. Didn't that work great? You know, triple the debt. Biggest stock market crash in the history of the United States, except for, of course, 1929. Crashed the savings and loans. Killed off the American workers. Killed off the unions. Started the destruction of our public education system. Hey, give us another chance. We can do better. This is the Republican shtick. And you know, again, I'm not saying that the Democrats are perfect. There is no shortage of Max Baucus Democrats out there, of Democrats who are, you know, dinos, Democrat in name only, who, you know, at least they're a vote to help out Harry Reid now and then, but only now and then. And that's why I think that we all need to get active. And one of the things that we need to do is get inside these political parties. If you are listening to this program and you consider yourself a conservative, please join the Republican Party and bring some sanity to them. Tell them to stop vetoing legislation that comes out of the House of Representatives when the Democrats control it, that says that we're no longer going to subsidize moving jobs offshore. We're doing that right now. We've been doing that ever since Reagan. We actually give subsidies to Mitt Romney's company when he tears down factories like Sensata, breaks them down brick by brick, and ships them overseas and rebuilds them over there. We actually give them a tax subsidy. And when they keep their money offshore, they actually get a tax advantage for that. Please let's not do that anymore. You've got major companies in the United States making as much from tax avoidance as they are from manufacturing products. Let's stop that. Now, I'll give you, there are some Democrats who think, oh, that's just fine. You know, we're going to go along with the corporate agenda. It, you know, Citizens United has created an environment where particularly red or purple districts that could very easily flip Republican, Democrats need to toe the line and be Republicans. Now, I get that. You know, it's a political reality, but if enough of us were to participate in this process and show up and say, yeah, I want to be a precinct committee chairperson. I want to, I'm going to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Those of you who are conservative, join the Republican Party. Those of you who are progressive, join the Democratic Party. Make things happen.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Ain't enough to sit in your armchair and complain about it. I mean, if that's your only option, I realize it is for some people, then you can pick up the phone or use your computer and get active. That's right. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Amazing stuff. Oh, gut microbes drive new. Is it time for geeky science, or is that, that's in the next? That's the, yeah, okay. All right. We will do that later. yeah, I was just going to riff about it. Well, actually, okay, great. Thank you. I can have my geeky science moment. Yes, it is my show. All right. Scientists have discovered, it's only going to be 3 minutes, I promise, and then we'll get to your calls. Scientists have discovered that the microbes in our gut actually control our ability to evolve. And by our, I don't just mean human beings. I mean every animal species on Earth, and probably most of the plants, because their roots are covered with bacteria and fungus and other things, mostly bacteria, that form a slime layer around them that actually the bacteria break down the minerals in the soil and turn them into organic forms and then transport them into the roots of the trees and other plants. So pretty much we all run on bacteria. So the question was, what is it that keeps different species from interbreeding easily and creating new hybrid species constantly? Why is it the species tend to stay the same? Why is it that humans can't interbreed with gorillas? Now, that would be a stretch, but there were some homo varieties that were fairly close at one time. Why couldn't they interbreed? Or, you know, why don't, you know, different kinds of wasps interbreed, for example? Or species that are very similar, different kinds of butterflies. Turns out it has to do with their gut bacteria. The gut bacteria, if they're not compatible, and they tend to be species-specific, if they're not compatible, then they prevent offspring from surviving. This is amazing. They did this study test on three jewel wasps, Nasonia is their genus, or their species, apparently. And they said that the microbiome has a major impact on their hosts, affecting everything from brain development to digestion. These wasps have 96 different groups of bacteria living in their gut. The mortality of hybrid offspring from closely related species was only 8%. And in contrast, the mortality of offspring between the species that diverged longer ago was more than 90%. So very interesting. Our gut bacteria, animal gut bacteria, are regulating evolution. Amazing. Swanson in Lillian, Alabama. Hey, Swanson, what's on your mind?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I just got one quick question. Mm-hmm. The hypocrites in Detroit, how can they possibly pay the quarterback of the Detroit Lions $41.5 million and come up and say they don't have any money in Detroit?
Well, because the city of Detroit is not paying.
Thank you much, sir. Appreciate it.
Yeah, the good people of the city of Detroit are not paying that salary. It's being paid by the corporation that is owned by the billionaire that owns the Detroit Tigers, or Detroit Lions, rather, who I don't know who that is, but it may not even be somebody who lives in Michigan. And that corporation does not depend upon Detroit, generally speaking. For anything other than tax breaks and free stadiums and stuff. So, you know, they get subsidies from the city, but the city, it's owned by William Clay Ford. He's the grandson of Henry Ford, Bill Ford. So he probably is a Detroiter, but he's the fourth richest county in the United States is one of the counties outside Detroit. So I believe it's Oakland County. And so it's not like Detroit is paying that salary. Does that make sense, Swanson?
That'll do it. I appreciate it.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot for the
call. I've never listened at the TV or on my telephone. Thank you very much. Have a good one. I enjoy your show.
Thanks, Swanson. You have a great one, too. Jason in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, the stuff about Detroit, I'm really having a big peeve with, because what's happening is people don't realize that since 1961, Democrats have had an essential monopoly on the state.
And on California and San Francisco. They've really gone down the tubes,
Let's stick on Detroit here.
Why?
And
there's lots of major cities that have been run by Democrats that are doing just fine, thank you very much.
Let's talk about Detroit, okay? They've had a half a century of political monopoly in the place. Okay.
Yeah,
the beginning of the exodus, began when we started having this model city program going into place. You realize Detroit pays the highest income taxes in the entire state. Okay. So the city's paying, you live in that city, you're paying the highest property and income tax in the state.
I don't know that for a fact. I would guess that that's certainly true of some of the Detroit suburbs.
Okay.
The average cost of a new house right now in Detroit, or the average cost of a house sold in Detroit proper right now is $7,000. So I don't think they're paying very much in property taxes.
This is great. This is absolutely perfect, because what happens is, what better place to start a business than Detroit? Because if 40% of a person's average monthly budget goes for housing, and I can buy a house for, you say, $7,000.
That's right.
Then I can probably set up the cheapest manufacturing in the entire country. But why aren't the businesses moving to Detroit if it's so cheap?
For the same reason the businesses do move to Portland, Oregon. And I can tell you, having lived in Portland, why businesses move there. They move there because there are great schools, because the roads are maintained, because the police respond quickly, because the schools are, I think I already said schools, the schools are really good. They've got one of the best hospital systems in the United States, OHSU. They have great infrastructure. There's a lot of green land. I mean, there's a lot of urban planning that goes on in Portland, Oregon. And so people want those utilities that...
Poor policies.
I beg your pardon?
This is an apology for poor policies. When somebody has a monopoly power for 50 years... And you know who the people that should be upset with the pension plans? The pension plans should be upset with their union, who when the people running the government were spending money willy-nilly, they didn't say, look, we can't spend this money. We have to ensure that the people that we've secured their pensions for get paid. They were not financially responsible.
The Constitution, of course they were financially responsible.
No,
the Constitution of the state of Michigan.
Liabilities.
The Constitution state of Michigan says that you may not discharge pension liabilities if you are a city. It's right there in the Constitution. Now, it's being ignored by Rick Snyder and the Republicans, but it's right there in the Constitution. So when people put their money into the pension fund, they assumed that that money was going to be there. You always have unfunded liabilities in pensions, Jason.
Not to the extent that you always have
unfunded pension liabilities, because pensions are, if you're looking at a pension, Jason, if you're looking at a pension right now, the people, you've got many people who are working right now who are not drawing from that pension. It is still accumulating money. That money is going to be paid out in the future. And then there's going to be new people working.
The amount of the unfunded liabilities is gigantic. And again, we're back to the same point. The union should have said, you know what?
That's not unique to Detroit.
What was that?
That is not unique to Detroit.
Oh, that's right.
There's a whole second issue here, Jason. If you want to, you know, you want to call with professional talking points, I mean, feel free and try. But the fact of the matter is, Paul Krugman did a great column on this about 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, that pensions have been for decades. And I'm talking about Republican cities, Democratic cities, Republican corporations, whatever, of all stripes. Pensions have been underfunded because pension actuarials have been using assumed growth rates, economic growth rates, of 4, 5, 6, 7%. And ever since we went into the era of Reaganomics, you could no longer use the pension growth rates that were used from 1950 to 1980 and worked during that time. My dad retired on one of those pensions that worked during that time. You can no longer use those because those numbers haven't worked since Reagan's presidency.
How is this Reagan? The exodus out of Detroit even began?
This is Reagan for two reasons. Number one, because if you want to talk about pensions, it's Reagan for two reasons. Number one, Reagan allowed pensions to be listed on the balance sheet of a company as an asset rather than a liability. Completely changed the way that they were calculated and the way that they were maintained. And number two, because Reaganomics has devastated this economy. We haven't seen 3% annual growth for a decade since the presidency of Ronald Reagan. We had it in the 70s, we had it in the 60s, we had it in the 50s, but we haven't had it since the 80s.
Tom, you got to go back to the same point.
And if you have a pension assuming at least 3% economic growth,
they had plenty of chances to reverse it. It's like a person smoking a pack of cigarettes a day for 50 years and you're surprised that they get cancer. This should have been nipped in the bud from a long time ago, and the exodus out of Detroit started beginning in 1967.
That you're talking about white flight.
City. What was that?
What you're talking about is white flight.
Yeah, and what did it begin with? In 1967, they broke up a party in the new model city. Okay, where the Democratic mayor at the time, he decided, you know,
Coleman
what?
Young.
He decides to wait. They had to send in two divisions of paratroopers.
Jason, I am not disagreeing that Coleman Young was a relatively incompetent mayor, fact of the matter is that ever since then, you have seen, as America has deindustrialized, through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, into today. Detroit deindustrialized faster than virtually any other city in America because it was arguably the most industrial city. So as our jobs got shipped over to China because of the free trade policies promoted by both parties, although they're a religion in the Republican Party, as Detroit got deindustrialized, those jobs left, the tax base left, then the public services left, then the companies that might want to move there because, hey, we would love to live in that city where it's cheap to live, but we have to have public services. Can't do it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that doesn't even begin to address the issue that I opened the show with day before yesterday of institutional racism. Taking back the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in for the news with Alan Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a crystal heart, a little piece of jewelry. It's a beautiful gift made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan. That's goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Alan.
Well, hi. You know, Tom, I want to know why all my friends, both Republican and Democrats in Congress, are a little crazy. So a friend of mine happens to be, unfortunately, I hate to say it, Steve King.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve King's been on the show many times. I was just ruminating on the air about how we should get him back on and ask him what?
Well, he gave a speech in Congress today. First of all, John Boehner said that his remarks were offensive, they were wrong, and they were not the values of the American people. And the border state Democrats also excoriated him today. Then he makes a speech on the floor of the House today.
Mm-hmm. And Steve King.
Is Steve King. And he talks about in Mexico there are drug smugglers and they get kids to be drug smugglers between 11 and 18 and that they try and smuggle drugs across the border and they have girls with heroin and cocaine being strapped to their bodies, teenage girls that they send across the border. And then he talks about sort of the history and Moses, and I'm wondering if he's like okay. He apparently, this speech, you got to pull it up, was beyond anything.
So you're starting to worry about your friend.
I'm starting to worry about him. I mean, you know, when we get older, our frontal lobes sort of decrease in size and we don't have the same kind of filters.
Well, and especially, I mean, you know, he's a Republican and John Boehner's living at the bar and maybe he's just been, you know, too much drinking will shrink your frontal
lobes. Or maybe he's joining him or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, what he said, apparently the House speech was something to behold.
Okay, I'll have to check it out.
Okay, Nancy Pelosi also talked she talked a little bit at her press briefing today. She talked about Mr. Weiner and Mr. Filner, and she said the conduct of both is reprehensible and disrespectful of women. She said if they need therapy, they should do it in private.
Yeah, I think Bob Filner should resign tomorrow, and I think you and I had this conversation yesterday. I think Anthony Weiner should get out of the race.
I always have a soft spot for these creeps.
Yeah, I understand, but, you know, I have a soft spot for them, too, after they've cleaned up their acts.
Right, well,
and,
that's
you know,
true.
It's like Bob May, you know, really cleaned up his act brilliantly.
In terms of whether Weiner should get out of a race, she said that was up to the people in New York.
Well, ultimately, it truly is.
Right.
And him and his wife.
Yes. The president gave a speech today in Jacksonville, Florida. He talked about infrastructure and creating jobs that last, and that is why he actually signed an executive order minimizing red tape to get the things clear in the port. And then he also talked about, he said, the businesses tomorrow are not going to locate near obsolete ports. also on the way down to Florida at what's called the gaggle. Josh Ernst, who is the deputy White House spokesperson, said House Republicans just don't have wrong answers for middle-class family. They're not even asking the right questions that will ensure middle-class families get a better bargain, including from infrastructure projects such as the port, that have historically received and actually deserve bipartisan support.
Right.
So that's what he talked about in terms of...
You know, the thing the Republicans are missing, you know, they talk about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and all that, and the easy cliched answer is that people have to have bootstraps. They also have to have boots. But even beyond that, they have to have a floor to stand on. And
right.
and the Republicans don't even want that. They don't want people to have, you know, basic security, basic health security, basic housing security, basic food security. It's incredible.
Well, and of course that's what this continuing issue about saying that they're going to stop the budget and stop any funding for Obamacare. So speaking of funding, this has to do with Egypt. The AP reports that the White House is going to say that this was not a military coup that got rid of Morsi, because if that's the case, then that aid goes away. And aid cannot be in a country where there are not apparently democratically elected leaders.
Well, couldn't you make a case, Ellen, that it's not technically a military coup because the people supported the military? So really the people turned out Morsi with the aid of the military. Rather than, I mean, typically a military coup is done against the will of the people, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. Totally against. The people have no voice, and you're right. In this one, they did have a voice. McCain and others want to continue the aid. However, you know, there were four F-16s that we were going to deliver to Egypt. We've decided not to do that at this point. Josh Ernst said that we're continuing to review our obligations under the law as it relates to all of this, and we're hopefully that officials in Egypt will continue to take the steps necessary.
Right.
Now, it's also interesting, Dennis Ross, who worked with my cousin Aaron David Miller for a very long period of time, says that it's very important that we continue aid to Egypt, because otherwise we will get backlash not only from the military, we'll get backlash from the people, and we can't afford that.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. And you know, I think it's a fine symbolic and practical act to withhold military aid. Was it you and I talking about it the other day about changing, or maybe Victoria and I, perhaps if we were to simply say our foreign aid policy going forward is going to be, we don't provide military to anybody. We provide schools, we provide hospitals, and we provide the infrastructure of governance.
No, you and I were not talking about
that.
But
I think it would cause us to automatically self-select for small D democratic societies, and it would eliminate the dictators.
Now, this is very interesting. Tony Rodham, who is Hillary Rodham Clinton's brother, has a company, and he has been doing business in China as well as other places. And he apparently has been trying to get visas for a Chinese company that was accused of spying. And now our deputy Homeland Security guy, they walked out of the hearing, the Republicans did in the Senate, because they were objecting to Tony Rodham.
Amazing. Well, I want to get more on that from you tomorrow. Ellen Radner, Talk Radio News Service, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And big goings-on over at the Department of Justice right now after the Supreme Court blew up the Voting Rights Act, or at least Section 4 of it, which said here are the states that have historically discriminated, and, you know, here's how we're putting forward these folks, these particular states and these particular counties that have to be looked at. The Justice Department is saying, no, there's another way around this. We can go back to this. And I find this absolutely fascinating. Myrna Perez is with us. She is the Senior Counsel and Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. The website for that center, of course, is brennancenter.org. Myrna, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It is a very interesting topic. I'm glad you're doing it.
I think it's fascinating that this actually might even work out better if you get the right judge and they can pull it off, unless I'm wrong on this, because this would allow a judge to actually bring in some of the places like in Pennsylvania, where you've got a Republican state legislator bragging about the fact that gerrymandering and voter suppression ID laws are going to help the Republican Party.
Well, I don't think it's accurate to say better. What I do think is accurate is to say that the voting rights community and voters are lucky that we have multiple tools to be able to combat race discrimination in voting, because as you mentioned, the Supreme Court rendered inoperable the most effective tool that we had. And being in the position that we're in, people are going to need to be creative and utilize the other provisions of the Voting Rights Act and other things like state and federal constitutions and state laws and other federal statutes to be able to protect voters. But that is not going to put us back on the kind of ground that we had before the Shelby County decision. But part of what it is that civil rights lawyers do is continue to move forward. My hope is that when that we'll see some successful suits using some of these other tools, and that we'll be able to convince Congress that they need to act to revisit and revise the Voting Rights Act as the Supreme Court invited them to do.
Yeah, although you have Republicans blatantly. Well, actually, let me, if I may, are you familiar with Paul Weyrich?
I'm not.
Okay,
not
this sure. This is the guy in 1980 who was in charge of the direct mail part of Ronald Reagan's campaign, one of his senior campaign advisors. He was the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation and the co-founder of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, the group that has been producing these voter suppression ID laws. And this is a speech that he gave to a group of Republican activists. This is just 20 seconds out of it, to a group of Republican activists in a church in Dallas, Texas, in 1980 during Reagan's campaign for presidency. Here he is.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
There you go. That was 33 years ago.
That is an unfortunate point of view. I think one that is out of touch with most Americans. I think most Americans believe that when you step into the ballot box that you are able to cast a ballot that is free from racial discrimination. And I think that voters will expect our Congress members to honor the promise that our Constitution makes, that people are going to be free from racial discrimination when they vote.
So what are the tools that the Department of Justice, we have Eric Holder now saying, you know, Texas isn't going to be the last, that we're going to use the remaining parts of the Voting Rights Act, mm-hmm. that he has evidence of ulterior motives, shall we say, in some of the gerrymandering that's going on and other things going on in Texas. What are some of the tools that he has available to him?
Sure. Well, there's Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is a provision that applies nationwide. It prevents a tool or device, which is broadly interpreted, that prohibits a tool or device from making it unable for voters to be able to fairly participate in the electoral process. And then we have Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act, which is what is covered here under the Texas case, in which the Department of Justice or an advocate could have a court make a finding whereby the jurisdiction would be subject to preclearance in some sort of manner. And so when I say preclearance, I mean they would be needing to submit their election changes before they got into effect. And the reason that Section 3 is different from perhaps Section 5, which was the part that was rendered inoperable by the Shelby County decision, is because Section 3 only becomes triggered when there's a finding of intentional discrimination. Mm-hmm. And in this day and age, it becomes very, very difficult to find someone so lacking in sophistication that they are careless about what it is that they say or what it is that they write, and it's very, very difficult to be able to meet the standard of intentional discrimination. Texas is in a different predicament because a three-judge court found just last year that in their redistricting plans, the legislature engaged in intentional discrimination. So it's a very interesting case to watch.
Now,
I know that another suit claiming or seeking Section 3, the bail-in provision, was filed last Friday, having to do with Alaska.
Now, here's Mike Terzai. He's the number one Republican in the state of Pennsylvania. He's the Speaker of the House of Representatives in that state. Listen to this.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Isn't that prima facie evidence of something?
It's certainly prima facie evidence of something. I think, you know, right now they're having the voter ID trial in Pennsylvania. I think we're all waiting and watching to see how that comes out. I think what's important for the readers to realize is that, you know, these big ticket items like, you know, voter ID laws, those get a lot of splash and attention because they are statewide and because they happen in a process whereby there is a lot of media attention, but we also need to be very mindful that we can have discrimination on the local level and part of the corners of the country where they don't have beat reporters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's extra important that we remain very vigilant in those communities because we're less likely to see the elite national media reporting on those.
How are those kind of things typically done? I know, you know, William Rehnquist made his chops in Arizona Republican politics by standing outside polling places in Native American communities and basically threatening people, demanding to see their ID and challenging them and scaring them off. But that was in the 60s. I mean, are they still doing that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, the kinds of changes that we are concerned about are those changes that happen outside public scrutiny. So, for example, you know, in a local election, canceling the election right before the election, or changing how they elect people. So, moving from a system whereby people are elected to a body that now people are appointed, or moving polling place locations and not telling anybody right before an election. Those are the kinds of things that are hard to find out about unless you live in that community and somebody in that community sounds the alarm.
Right. So these are more structural.
We're really hoping that your readers will be, that your viewers will be listening out for these kinds of issues, and when those things kind of happen, report them as they can.
And they can report them to you at the Brennan Center?
They should call 866-OUR-VOTE. 866-OUR-VOTE. There's someone that'll take an intake there, and you know, we're available on the website. When, you know, we certainly get lots of emails from interested viewers and interested organizations and interested audience members, and we are a public interest organization that tries to respond as quickly as we can.
That is great, Myrna. The Brennan Center for Justice, BrennanCenter.org, 866. You said, Myrna.
866
OURVOTE, Our Vote. Myrna, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Have you noticed how NPR lately has been having the Heritage Foundation on constantly, and the Economic Policy Institute, and it's just, I'm scratching my head. Why are all these right wingers on, and they're not putting on Senator Bernie Sanders, and they're not putting on, well, I don't want to say me because I really don't aspire to be on NPR, but the equivalent. You know, good progressive voices. I don't get it. I'm baffled. Well, actually, I do get it. NPR is dependent increasingly on corporate donations, and those corporate donations come, you know, with strings attached. Frida in Fresno, California. Hey, Frida. What, you wanted to talk about Detroit and race?
Yes, Tom. It's so good to speak with you.
Thank you for calling.
Yes, we were talking about poverty, breeding crime.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Irish and the Italians coming here. And after perhaps two generations, they would be assimilated.
Yes.
And because of our skin color, blacks, we were not able to break this cycle.
Yes.
So easily.
That's my theory.
Well, I agree with you 100%. And it's so pure and simple. I just wonder why it's not discussed more and really not understood. But I would like to add something to that. As far as the Irish and the Italians and the rest of the immigrants, they came here of their own volition.
There's that too, yes.
Yes, and blacks were forced here and forced into slave labor, stripped of their mythologies, stripped of their names, families torn apart. And this awful degradation of humanity has forced us into a cycle, these endless cycles of crime. And what I wanted to add to that is with what's going on in Detroit, I've always thought that there should be a form of reparations, something similar to the Marshall Plan that was happened in Germany after World War II. This was, but in our particular case for blacks, I really think we have to have a sort of a sustained Marshall Plan that will foster these poor, downtrodden people, all of us, into a better lifestyle. And I do believe the government owes that because to this, to the blacks, reparations, in the form of reparations. And I always thought perhaps maybe with Detroit in this state, that would be an excellent starting point, I would think. What do you think? Does that sound like I'm hallucinating or what?
I don't disagree with you, Frida, and I would add Native Americans to that as well. The other, you know, the group that was here before African Americans or Caucasians, you know, whose land we all took. African Americans didn't take it; it wasn't their choice. But the biggest pockets of poverty in the United States, the most downtrodden people, are the American Indians, the Native Americans, and in both cases there was both a cultural genocide perpetrated. And you're absolutely right, and that's something I left out of my rant the other day, and I shouldn't have. I should have pointed that out, because it's usually, I usually do when I talk about Native Americans, because it's so obvious, but it should be equally obvious that when a people lose their connections to their past, they lose their connections to their ancestors. The Irish have assimilated, but they still, you know, they still know that they have aunts and uncles back in the homeland sort of thing, and they know who they are. And they know what the stories of their family are, and they know what the history of their family is. And if they want to learn Gaelic, they can. And for a lot of African Americans, they have no idea what part of Africa they came from. They have no idea what the story of their community was before they came here. They don't even really have any idea of the first few generations of their people here in this country. And go ahead.
Well, you know, I was thinking with Obama, our first black president, I was just wondering, it would be great if he could somehow foster a program that would permit all blacks to have this, what are these tests that you can trace your ancestry through, take blood from your arm, what do you call that?
Well, they do DNA tests that are a form of genealogy, I guess, genealogical DNA.
Henry Louis Gates had such a program where you could trace your ancestors. And
yes.
I was just wondering if Obama would just simply come up with some kind of program that would help blacks to trace their genealogy.
I wonder if he has had – pardon my interrupting.
No, go ahead.
I wonder if he has had this conversation with Michelle, because Michelle comes from a lineage of slavery. On the other hand, Barack Obama, his father was a Kenyan who came to the United States as a student, and his mother was a white person. And so he, although you can call him an African-American president, he did not grow up being told stories of slavery by his father. In fact, his father was absent. I'm guessing he heard them from the larger African-American community and culture around him. But that he could always kind of fall back on, well, that's not my story. If he wanted to, I don't know what kind of psychological defense mechanisms he used as a youth, or now, but that direct experience of slavery is found in Michelle's family. It's not found in his family. And I have no idea if he and if the two of them have ever had that conversation and what his position is on this. It would be pure speculation. But I do agree with you that we have to make this right somehow. And I think that Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program was an attempt to begin that process. And LBJ saw the Great Society as a beginning, as a let's get 20% into this. And if we can demonstrate that it works, then let's go all the way. And it did work. It cut poverty in half in the United States in 10 years. And it radically cut poverty in the African-American community and provided the basis for a large part of the African-American middle class. But, you know, LBJ didn't survive, the program didn't survive, Reagan became president, and that was the end of that. So I'm with you. It's time for 40 acres and a mule. Frida, we're out of time. Thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Pantagruelianly ugly, the good. Julian Assange. Today, the WikiLeaks founder announced that he will run for Senate in his home country of Australia on, you guessed it, the WikiLeaks party ticket. In an interview with the New York Times, Assange said that his decision to join politics was the logical conclusion of his work blowing the lid off of government secrets. He said, "My plans are to essentially parachute into a crack troop of investigative journalists into the Senate and to do what we have done with WikiLeaks and holding banks and government and intelligence agencies to account." Sounds like a plan indeed. If only more of our elected representatives here in the U.S. had dreams like this. Best of luck to you, Julian. The bad. Rush Limbaugh's. During a discussion about the NFL on yesterday's broadcast of his radio show, the conservative pundit revealed that he's a truther, a concussion truther. Check this out.
"The conventional wisdom is that concussions cause all these things, and there's no argument. You don't argue. It's like there's global warming, and if you say there isn't, you are a denier.
Contrary.
Why not link steroids and dementia? See, dementia and a lot of weightlifters have never had concussions. Why don't we link steroids to it? Why don't we link human growth hormone? Why don't we? I mean, this stuff never, ever ends. But it's absurd."
Contrary to what Rush says, most medical professionals do believe there is a definite link between concussions and dementia. It's bad enough that Rush uses his powerful position in the right-wing media to spread lies about the president and his policies. But misleading people about their health isn't just questionable journalism, it's downright irresponsible, not to mention dangerous. And the very, very ugly, Ted Nugent. Nugent? Nugent? Whatever. During his Tuesday appearance on the Andrea Tantaros show, the far-right pundit blamed Stevie Wonder's decision not to perform in Florida until that state it repeals its Stand Your Ground, Shoot First law on drug use. Take a listen.
"Well, you know, when you're living in a fog of denial, and usually it's inspired by just a lifetime of substance abuse, and you know, with all the lies about, you know, dope being a victimless crime, I think you're listening to the victims of this dopey crime."
Well, you know, odds are pretty slim that Nugent himself is using drugs, because when you're already hallucinating, why bother? Anyway, that's just very, very ugly. Amazing. So somebody called earlier and said Rick Perry's sister stands to profit from the outlaw of the abortion clinics in Texas. Basically, the only abortion clinics, there was some 20-odd or 30-odd clinics in the state, and the vast majority, I mean, you know, 97.5% of all the abortions done were not these second trimester or later abortions. They were first trimester abortions, but nonetheless, or they were even, you know, here, take this pill, come back in 2 days kind of abortions. But now they've all been forced into these surgical centers. And here's where it gets really interesting. This is from the Houston Chronicle. Okay? And you can find this online. It's Friday, July 5th, 2013, Houston Chronicle, in their Texas Politics blog. And they talk about what I just shared with you. And it says, if the bill passes, which it has, only five Texas abortion clinics would remain open, those that are already equipped as ambulatory surgical centers. But a question remains, would the 420 other ambulatory surgical centers that exist in Texas begin performing that operation? Abortion rights advocates predict that the demand for the procedure isn't going to go away with the passage of the law, and therefore some of these companies, now that's the end of what it says there, this is my commenting, and therefore some of those companies might step up and say, hey, here's an income opportunity. I don't know, but here's where it goes, here back to the blog. One company that will be faced with that decision is United Surgical Partners International, based in Addison, Texas. Their vice president of government affairs is Mila Perry Jones, Governor Rick Perry's sister. She's also on the board of directors of the Texas Ambulatory Surgical Center Society. It should be noted that the legislation now under consideration by the Texas legislature is patterned after proposals that have been adopted in other states, so it didn't originate in Rick Perry's office. Rich Parsons, a Perry spokesperson, said he could not say whether Perry had discussed the legislation with his sister. So, interesting. So, for those of you who have gotten the viral email saying Rick Perry's sister owns, you know, or has a share in the five remaining ambulatory surgical center abortion clinics, apparently she doesn't. She works for an ambulatory surgical center, which is not an abortion clinic, or for a chain of them. And she is on the board of the Texas Ambulatory Surgical Center Society. Now, it may be that the five abortion clinics that are ambulatory surgical centers also are members of that society. But, you know, so this sounds to me more like the kind of thing that is just, you know, if it were being done by right-wingers, I would be calling it out as a smear. So, I think it's a tempest in a teapot. But it's interesting, you know, when people call in and say something like that, I think it's important to check it out. So, Jim in Sullivan, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, I called to see, you know, I'm curious. I wonder how much free lunch Detroit actually got, you know, the card manufacturers for the last 60 years. That includes the tax breaks on real estate and utilities. And the government money that they got to move elsewhere. I wonder how much money that was in. And let's not forget Romney with Adelphi, the parts manufacturer there. That really was a shot. And did you hear about the city council up in Chicago going to float a loan to Wrigley Field for $500 million to remodel Wrigley Field while they're closing schools? I wonder how much bribe money that those council people got. Yeah. And I remember when Reagan passed that law, Reagan passed that law to fleece the pensioners.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I lived up in Elgin, Illinois. They used to have a watch factory there. Mm-hmm. And then the owner started fleecing the pension fund like crazy. And Paul Simon had to fight to keep it in that. And the thing about the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, did you know that that was started after World War II by either Scorsese or Joaquin Piper, you know, a couple of Nazis? Those Nazis are actually the ones who started that.
I believe the Muslim Brotherhood was founded by a man named Khattab, who had lived in St. Louis in the United States, an Egyptian who went back to Egypt, and Anwar al-Awlaki, if I'm remembering. Well, no, I may have the name wrong. I'm mixing up my people. But anyhow, Khattab, there's a Adam Curtis did a great documentary on that, actually. It has the word terror in it. So I'm guessing if you put the word terror and Adam Curtis into the search engine on YouTube, you will be able to see it. But that's, and I think it's pretty authoritative. But the other things you've mentioned are good questions. I would guess it's tens of billions of dollars at least that those corporations sucked out of that city before they left. And, you know, and you correctly point out Mitt Romney and his company made their share out of it too, you know, moving the jobs overseas. So it's grim stuff, Jim. It's really grim stuff. Todd in Anoka, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I appreciate you taking my call. Not to belabor the Detroit point too much, but I think having read your book, Cracking the Code, which I really recommend to anybody who listens to you, I just wonder if you wouldn't agree that Detroit is now a new code word on the right wing for what they used to say, inner city, and that went to urban, which was just another way to foist their racism.
Yeah, because they're all code words for black people. Yeah, and Chicago.
I think that's what they're doing with Detroit right now. Yes, Chicago as well.
Yeah, yeah. Chicago thugs or Chicago killers, and it's all. Yes, I absolutely agree. And what it does is, you know, I was talking about this the other day, is you have institutional racism. Go back to that Harvard 2004 study that showed that when you submit identical resumes to big corporations that have names like Letitia versus names like Alice with identical qualifications, Alice gets a whole lot more callbacks for job interview than Letitia does. And the same thing with housing, just right across the board, pretty much everything, that when you look at institutional racism, it creates poverty, and then poverty destroys communities, and then white people look at those destroyed poor communities of color and say, oh, this must be because these people are black. And to some extent it is because the white people have made it that way. But the white people who don't think beyond the surface of it think it must have something to do with blackness rather than something to do with white racism that is keeping black people down. And so they use that to justify their own racism. And then they start talking about in Detroit and Chicago in code. I think you're absolutely right, Todd. Excellent point, and thank you for calling and making it. And thank you for listening to Minnesota's Progressive Voice. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. 44, coming up on 45 minutes past. And you can drop into our free live chat room over at tomhartman.com. It's free, it's fun, kind of cool.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Limbaugh, Rush Limbaugh, we got into this in the first hour. Economic recovery is not caused by the middle class, really? I think you're wrong. Okay, welcome back. If I discovered something that Shane was wrong about, I am so pleased, so proud of myself. I'm probably wrong. Article 6, oh, wait a minute, it's not Article 6. Amendments. Amendment 6. Okay, somebody just called a minute ago and said, oh, yeah, you're right, Shane. I was wrong. Okay. And said, if you are a member of a jury, you cannot be prosecuted or persecuted or harassed or imprisoned or anything for making the decision on any damn basis you want. So the six jurors in the George Zimmerman trial could just as easily have said, we don't care what the judge's instructions are. We think, you know, because this juror came out today and said George Zimmerman got away with murder, but given the judge's instructions, the jury instructions, we had to find him not guilty. And, you know, the reality is if you believed he was guilty, you could find him guilty. And there's nothing the judge can do about it. And so then I then told the story about being when I was down in Atlanta, there's a group of us had gotten together one night, local small business people, and a bunch of them were lawyers. And one of them, a guy named Tom Rogers, an old friend of mine who has since passed on, Tom said, you know, here's the way to get out of jury duty if you ever want to. And I'm not suggesting this. I think jury duty is a responsibility of citizenship. But Tom was just, you know, we were telling stories. And Tom says, all you have to do is ask the judge when he says, do you have any questions? Ask the judge, Your Honor, is it true that as a juror, I can make the decision, the ultimate decision, based on my own common sense or whatever I believe the evidence to be, rather than based on your instructions? And is it true that I have the right to personally stand up and say, I would like to question that witness? Now, I'm guessing that probably varies from state to state, but that's the law in Georgia. And Tom said, just ask that question out loud in court and watch what happens. And I said, how do you know? He says, I've done it. And And he said what they will do is they will not only reject you for jury duty, but they will clear the room of every other single person who is eligible for jury duty who heard you say it. And so anyhow, then I said, yeah, that's the Seventh Amendment, isn't it? Jury duty. And the Seventh Amendment, of course, says in suits of common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. Now, I thought the Sixth Amendment was just speedy trial. And so I said, and Shane said, no, it's the Sixth Amendment. And for criminal trials, trial of jury. And I said, no, the Sixth Amendment is just about speedy trial, isn't it? And he said, no. So here's the Sixth Amendment. In all criminal, Shane was right. In all criminal prosecutions, never argue with somebody who graduated from law school, right? In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, blah, 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 blah. And to be confronted with a witness against him and to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. What's amazing to me is that assistance for counsel for his defense, that really didn't, I mean, we didn't actually start doing that until, what, the 40s or 50s? There was a Supreme Court case that pushed that through. It's pretty impressive, or pretty amazing. Anyhow, a little bit of trivia. Kyle in Redford, Michigan. Hey, Kyle, you wanted to talk about Detroit?
Hi. Yeah, Tom, it's good to talk to you. I'm right on the border of Redford and Detroit.
I know the area.
Hey, yeah.
I used to live in
Westland.
There
is a lot of stuff. Okay, yeah, my girlfriend lives in Westland. One thing, you had a caller earlier that just was making me, you know, nuts listening to him because he's trying to say, oh, it's Democrats' fault, it's unions' fault, it's all that.
Yeah.
No one seems to say that some of these corporations that owe property taxes, they bear some responsibility here.
Because they're not paying them?
That's because they're not paying them. The owner of the Red Wings, Tigers, and Little Caesars Pizza, he owes upwards of $3 million in property taxes.
Whoa.
From the old Tiger Stadium in 2003.
Whoa.
Yeah. Also, the city, with its furlough days,
mm-hmm.
which was directed by Snyder and the
Kevin Orr, his emergency manager, yeah. Little
yeah,
Dictator.
They've directed a lot of those furlough days. Sometimes business owners who don't even owe property are just like, okay, I guess I got to pay this because I didn't pay it, you know, in 2005 or 2007 or whatever.
Right.
They show up to pay it, and there's nobody there to take it because there's nobody that can handle finances.
Because they're on furlough.
They're on furlough, yeah.
Brilliant.
So there's a lot of stuff, and then there's so many empty houses that the city is trying to account for on for revenue,
mm-hmm.
but the property has been abandoned.
Right, and stripped.
And stripped.
Yeah.
So we do have a mess here, and I know you know this area quite well. And
yeah.
I mean, I see this stuff on social media all the time, and it drives me nuts because I happen to live here, and we have good things happening, like riverfront properties, the Artist Village, which you would love.
Mm-hmm. I used to love Greektown. It was one of my favorite
yeah,
places.
Yeah, Greektown still looks good.
Yeah.
I mean, in the New Center area, Henry Ford Theater, they're doing
mm-hmm.
stuff down there, jazz bands, movies, the whole works.
Yeah.
You know, and our public radio station, they're right there around the corner. I used to work there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nightmare right now, but there's so many misconceptions. And then I don't know if you know with the How do I put this? With the business taxes,
mm-hmm.
Virg Bonero had said, I think he said it on your show or maybe Ed Schultz,
mm-hmm.
that he proposed no business taxes if you want to go into Detroit.
Right. Virg is the mayor of Lansing, Michigan.
Yes.
Yeah.
I probably voted for him.
Yeah. He's a good guy. He's a genuine progressive. One, you know, one of the more outspoken ones in Michigan and a guy that I would love to see as governor of Michigan. And someday maybe he'll have a shot at it, although the DeVos family is going to do everything they can to keep that from happening. You know that for a fact. Oh, man. I'm amazed he's politically survived as long as he has, you know, given what's arrayed against him. Kyle, I got to go. Thank you for the call, and thanks for the update and the information and the stories from my old hometown. When I was 2 years old, my parents lived in Detroit, so I lived in Detroit down on 14th. Area that burned during the riots in the 70s. But back when we lived there in the early 50s, it was essentially a Jewish ghetto. The family across the street were Holocaust survivors, and they took care of me during the day, which is why my first language was not English, it was Yiddish. So, anyhow, coming up tomorrow, it's Friday, and that means it's Brunch with Bernie. It's been a busy week on the Hill, and Senator Sanders will be talking about it and taking your calls. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, occupy something, tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.